KLN, and we're continuing on with a series of mind control in Canada. We've heard over the last 3 weeks a lecture by Dr. Colin Ross about the history of the CIA and military mind control experimentation programs, documented history. Today, we're going to start an interview, part one of a two-part interview with Dr. Colin Ross as we go into a bit more detail and explore the other many issues around this situation. You're listening to CKLN 88.1. I'm speaking with Dr. Colin Ross, a psychiatrist and researcher practicing in Dallas, Texas. And Dr. Ross, I wonder if you could just briefly describe who you are and what your current work is.
Sure. I'm a Canadian by birth and training. I went to medical school in Edmonton and did my psychiatry training in Winnipeg. I moved down here to Dallas just a little over 5 years ago. I'm a specialist in multiple personality disorder, and I've written a number of different books and lots of research papers and so on that. Right now, I'm working at a hospital in the Dallas area here. We have a program that we run on contract for the hospital, which treats mostly people with multiple personality disorder, also other related disorders. Most of the people that we treat describe very traumatic and abusive childhoods.
Now, what is a dissociative identity disorder, and is it the same thing as multiple personality disorder?
A dissociative identity disorder is the official new name for multiple personality disorder. It hasn't really caught on in the general language. It's a professional technical term. In 1994, that new diagnosis was introduced. It just replaces multiple personality disorder, and the criteria for diagnosing it have been changed a little bit, basically by adding a requirement for some type of amnesia. But basically it means the same thing as multiple personality.
So what does it mean when somebody has this disorder?
Well, the basic criteria for diagnosing it are pretty straightforward. You have these different personality states or identities that take turns being in control of the body, and there's some sort of amnesia or a memory barrier between the different personality states. Several important points to understand about this disorder are, first of all, it's not literally true that they have different personalities. They just have these fragmented components of one personality, and those have been referred to as different personalities for over 100 years, but they're not literally different personalities. There isn't really more than one person there. And there's several different ways you can end up having multiple personality. One way, which is what we think we see most of the time clinically, is where you've basically been physically, sexually, emotionally abused or neglected as a child. And you create these different identities to cope with it and hold different memories and feelings about it and so on. And that can be, as I said, a combination of various types of trauma in childhood. It has to be fairly serious trauma, usually. Then another way that you can get multiple personality is where it's created either by mistake or deliberately by somebody else. And that could be in a bad therapy, which is all out of control and not being handled properly. And then the other major way of arriving at multiple personality disorder is people who have what's called a factitious disorder. That means that they deliberately fake having it, either to get into the patient role or get attention or get out of something or for some specific purpose.
Now, have you seen this disorder occur due to trauma as an adult, or does it specifically happen while a child?
Well, there's some cases reported in the literature, and there's the odd case where it's trauma that starts in adulthood, but vast majority of time it seems to be childhood.
Right. We've listened to your lecture talking about the history of U.S. mind control. You refer to the term iatrogenic. What does that mean?
Iatrogenic is just a Greek word that means created by the doctor. So iatrogenic multiple personality is multiple personality that's created by mistake by a bad therapist who's using improper techniques.
Okay. How did you get involved in working with people suffering from DID?
Well, I've actually diagnosed my first case when I was a medical student in Edmonton and just instantly found it really fascinating and interesting. And then when I was doing my 4 years of psychiatry training in Winnipeg, I saw one more case, and I thought it was going to be too rare to really specialize in. But then in 85, when I finished my psychiatry training, I diagnosed another case, and then I got some referrals and then more referrals, and then I got a reputation for it and ended up getting lots of referrals from all kinds of different people in Western Canada, and gradually sort of switched over to that being my specialty.
And this was when you were operating a practice in, is it Winnipeg or Edmonton at the time?
Yeah, Winnipeg.
Right.
I was a full-time university professor of psychiatry at one of the hospitals there.
And what did you find from, what were your findings from working with people with DID or MPD?
Well, I've published just on multiple personality and related things. I've published probably about 60 or so papers in the professional literature, so I've found quite a few different things. But the main theme is, it really goes through the whole multiple personality literature, and that is that people who have this diagnosis clinically have lots of other things going on at the same time. Lots of depression, lots of anxiety, drug and alcohol problems, eating disorder problems, sleep problems. So they don't just have multiple personality. They got all kinds of different symptoms. They also tend to be in the healthcare system for quite a long period of time. Not all the time, but the majority of cases are in the healthcare system getting psychiatric treatment for one thing or another for quite a while, on average about 7 years, before the multiple personality is diagnosed. And the other theme that we see going all the time is this childhood trauma that arises as a way of coping with childhood trauma. And then we just actually found out this week that a paper has been accepted at the American Journal of Psychiatry where we assessed 103 people with this diagnosis here in Dallas about almost exactly 4 years ago now. And we gave them a whole bunch of different questionnaires and standardized tests and interviews and so on. And then we followed up as many as we could 2 years later, and we were able to follow up 54 of them. And the reduction in all these different symptoms was really impressive. And 12, already in the first 2 years of follow-up, 12 of the 54 people were all integrated back into one person. So they had a really dramatic and meaningful reduction in not just the amount of multiple personality-related symptoms, but depression, anxiety, substance abuse, all kinds of things. So this is the first scientifically designed kind of treatment outcome study that really shows that good treatment can be very helpful.
So these people that you're talking about did undergo treatment with you or other therapists?
They came to our hospital usually for an average of about 17 days or so.
Mm-hmm.
70% of our people are from outside Texas, so they're from all over the United States. And we've had probably about 15 admissions of people from Ontario. And they then go home and are followed up by their therapist. So they only get about usually 2, 3, sometimes 4 weeks with us. And they may go into our day hospital program for a little bit as well. But basically they're followed up by therapists all over the country.
And are these therapists in contact with you in terms of methods of therapy?
Yeah, they've usually read my books and been to some of my workshops and are aware of my approach. But they don't have to necessarily follow my approach.
Right. And these other symptoms that you were talking about, do you feel that they were also a result of childhood trauma?
Yeah, the whole package seems to be related to childhood trauma. Now, we got a lot of controversy about this going on in society, in the psychology, psychiatry, sociology, and so on.
Right.
And we need a lot more research. But that's the best understanding I have right now. And there's a fair bit of research data that backs that up. It's not totally nailed down scientifically.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, from your experience working in Canada, how has the Canadian medical system responded to your findings in MPD research?
Well, roughly about the same as American. Overall, there's a lot of skepticism, a lot of political agitation, a fair bit of negative hostile propaganda and backstabbing about it. And then there's also quite a lot of support. And obviously, if I've gotten 50 or 60 professional papers published, I'm getting a reasonable reception. The main difference between Canada and the United States was, in Canada, I just couldn't get the financial or clinical support to set up and run a program. And the reason that's possible down here is because there's a private for-profit sector in the mental health system that's profit-driven, that's a business. And the hospital corporation I contract with is traded on the New York Stock Exchange and so on. And since I attract patients, then there's a financial motive for the hospital to be interested in me providing that service.
Hmm.
So that financial motive allows the system to sort of set aside all of these ideological and political debates that go on, and so therefore I'm able to run a program.
So for the survivors of childhood abuse that you're dealing with, I guess they would have to have access to some kind of funds to be able to undergo therapy. What is your sense of people that have undergone this in childhood that do not have access to therapy?
Well, the breakdown in terms of insurance coverage that we have in our program is roughly about 50% are on Medicare, which is a government disability program. So they're sort of like Canadian healthcare system people in that their health insurance is basically paid for by the government. And they also get disability welfare type payments for their basic support and living. So half of our people are really insured in a way fairly similar to Canada. And then the other half have some sort of private insurance through their employers or their spouse's employers. If you're in the one-third of people in the United States who don't have proper medical insurance, then you can't get proper medical care, including psychiatric and including the kind we provide. So that would seem to be probably a reason to think that the Canadian healthcare system is superior to the U.S. The funny thing is that if you have multiple personality or a related disorder, your odds of getting treatment are actually better in the United States because there's more programs and more therapists available. In Canada, even though you have universal access and universal coverage, in actual practical reality, you can't get the treatment. So you've got theoretical universal coverage for multiple personality and trauma-related disorders, but you don't have real practical coverage in reality. So that's sort of the paradox is that in the United States, actually a higher percentage of people who could benefit from psychotherapy for all kinds of problems arising from their childhoods, who can actually get therapy, is higher in the U.S.
Interesting. Now, in your previous lecture, you did go into a lot of detail outlining the history of mind control. What is the link between MPD and mind control experimentation?
Well, how I got into this is sort of a backdoor route. I didn't really have any interest in the CIA or the military or mind control research or all of that, particularly when I left Canada. Hadn't read about it, hadn't really heard any other doctors talking about it, hadn't heard any patients talking about it. And pretty soon after I arrived in Texas in early 1992, the multiple personality patients started talking about kind of real strange experiences that I didn't know what to make of. It involved either going into hospitals, some sort of research setting somewhere on a military base and having different kinds of experiments done on them, which involved EEG machines or some kind of scientific equipment and sensory deprivation, maybe physical spinning, maybe hallucinogens. And it wasn't any kind of cult, and obviously wasn't just their parents or something going on in their family. And initially I thought that was really too much to believe. But then I decided I should at least look into it a little bit. So I started basically in early 92 doing a little bit of reading. And the more reading I did, what amazed me was that instead of coming to the conclusion, oh, well, this is not possible, there's no documentation of this kind of stuff, actually, the more I read, the more documentation I got that all kinds of absolutely unbelievable and bizarre and unethical and harmful mind control research has been done in Canada and the United States since the Second World War. And I've actually interviewed and spoken with a number of people who have documented mind control research. Most of the patients that we work with who we hear these kind of things from, we get zero documentation that it's actually real. Mm. So I kind of disconnected my research and my study about this from the stories I was hearing from the patients and did it as a separate research project. And what I've done then over the last 5 years is talked to lots of other people in the field who are interested in this, read pretty well everything that's written on it, and through the Freedom of Information Act, I've got somewhere in probably in the ballpark of 6,000 or 7,000 pages of documents from the CIA, which I've reviewed, and then I've gone to the medical school library, and I've sent my secretary to 5 or 6 different places in the United States to go into archives and special collections and library resources and so on. So I've ended up now with probably more than almost 2 full 4-drawer filing cabinets full of documentation on all kinds of things. That's basically how I got into this. And the connection with multiple personality, for me personally, was just that my multiple personality patients were the ones who started telling these kind of stories and got me interested in it.
Right. Now, from from a therapist's point of view, how do you tell if somebody is giving you an account of actual abuse or whether they're just fabricating something?
Well, basically, all the professional associations, including the Canadian Psychiatric Association, that have made statements on this, and all the scientific research completely supports the conclusion that you can't tell. And that goes both ways.
You cannot tell.
You can't tell for sure just by listening to the patient's story.
Hmm.
You can't tell that it's true. Also, you can't tell for sure that it's false. In other words, you can't tell one way or the other without some sort of outside proof. That is, proof that it really happened or proof that it really didn't happen. And what I've learned, especially in the last 5 years, is there's really no limit to how detailed, how compelling, how full of feeling, how detailed a bunch of memories can be and be either totally real or never have happened.
Hmm.
I've worked with people who've had really, really, really elaborate memories of all kinds of things with tremendous amount of detail, and then we've been able to prove it never happened.
Right, so that's...
People can't tell, and that's why I decided to do this research kind of separated off from what the patients were telling me.
Right. Now, what similarities have you come across within the survivor accounts and what you've discovered in the CIA documentation about their mind control programs?
Well, basically, if you take a typical elaborate story that you'll hear from one of multiple personality patients who have these kind of memories, and you break it down into the elements or components of the mind control techniques that they describe, I've been able to document just about every one, with maybe one or two exceptions. And all of this was carried out in a series of programs that really began in the Second World War with what was called the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services.
The precursor to the CIA?
Yeah. It was set up immediately after Pearl Harbor when it became obvious that there was a huge problem with U.S. military intelligence gathering because they were totally surprised by the Japanese. And so it was set up in about 1941. And then at the end of the war, the OSS was disbanded. And then 2 years later, the personnel were rolled over into the CIA, which was created in September 1947 through the National Security Act. Basically the same people who had been in the OSS. And the OSS did various kinds of drug research and mind control research, including with hallucinogens and so on, and marijuana and sodium amytal and so on, and different types of drugs. Also, they did experiments with hypnosis. There's then a little bit of a gap before the CIA started up a series of programs in 1951. There was two programs called Artichoke and Bluebird that ran until about 1953, and they were rolled over into MKUltra, which ran from 1953 to 1964. Then MKUltra was rolled over into MKSearch, which ran up till 1973. And then running concurrently with MKUltra and MKSearch, there's roughly about 10 other programs that are declassified. And there's a little smattering of information on each of those. They have names like MKNaomi and QK Hilltop and MKDelta. The by far the best known and the one that I have the most documents on is MKUltra.
Mm-hmm.
It involved 149 different separate contracts at about 80 different institutions all around Canada and the United States. And in MKNaomi, MKUltra, and MKSearch, there's basically about three major blocks of types of mind control research. About half the projects in MKUltra, for instance, were on some sort of procurement of chemicals, supplying chemicals or manufacturing chemicals, which is mostly hallucinogens, sometimes biological warfare weapons, such as bacteria and viruses, and sometimes other types of chemicals for mind control research. So it was just straight contracting to get the chemicals. An example of that would be in 1953, one of the MKUltra sub-projects was a $400,000 grant to Eli Lilly, which is the drug company that manufactures Prozac,
mm-hmm.
and that was for manufacturing LSD. So the first major supplier of LSD in North America was actually Eli Lilly Drug Company.
And there's evidence that the CIA had was responsible for the distribution of this throughout the United States and North America?
Yeah, they used it in actual experiments. And they also turned some of it over to the military through their MKNaomi program. A lot of the Army mind control and drug research was done at Edgware Arsenal, which has been in the news a lot recently because of a lot of sexual assault and rape of female army personnel there. And it's in it's linked to Fort Detrick and Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland, sort of north, a little bit north of Washington, D.C.
Is this the same military base that the BBC documentary was done about them giving very powerful drugs to U.S. soldiers?
Yeah. Yeah, that it was the major center for all kinds of hallucinogen and other drug research. The main one that's best known is LSD, but actually the Army released a list of about 130 different compounds that it tested in mind control research. And that was released in 1975. So there's at least 130 different drugs and different types of compounds that they admit using on experimental subjects. And they admit to, again, in the mid-70s, they admitted to testing LSD on at least 1,500 subjects. So if you just do the arithmetic very roughly, if they gave LSD to 1,500 people and they tested 130 different drugs, that was just the Army. And you figure there's four branches of the military in the United States plus the CIA. You're talking about a huge number of people, potentially hundreds of thousands of people, who got at least one dose of some experimental mind control drug, usually without any kind of adequate informed consent at all.
Now, who typically would these people be? Where are they drawing their subjects from?
Actually, I'd just like to pop back to talking about Eli Lilly for a second, just
sure.
Finish off that part of the story, and then I'll answer that question.
Okay.
LSD was discovered accidentally in 1943 by a man named Albert Hoffman working at Sandoz Pharmaceuticals in Switzerland, mm-hmm. which is a drug company. And what happened was that in the late 40s, early 50s, a rumor developed that the Russians might try to buy up the entire world supply of LSD. So that's why the CIA decided to contract with the drug company in the United States that manufactures Prozac, which is Eli Lilly, so they could have a secure North American supply. And one of the things that amazed me absolutely the most doing this background research was to find out who the original acid heads were in North America. Because you would assume it'd be beatniks or criminals or musicians or somebody or other. It turns out that the original acid heads in North America were actually the psychiatrists and the CIA and military personnel. And in conferences that were financially sponsored by the CIA that resulted in books, I've got dozens of these psychiatrists who are some of the major drug researchers and major psychiatrists in the second half of the 20th century, all describing the acid trips they were on, how much they enjoyed them, how useful they thought they were, and describing using LSD to treat all kinds of different things, from alcoholism to anxiety to even homosexuality, which they considered to be a disease. So they were themselves turning themselves and each other on, and then they were using all kinds of different subjects. The majority would be either psychiatric patients who are already in treatment, army personnel, prisoners in several different prisons in the United States, or in one project, which was through MKUltra, they actually had prostitutes that they hired through MKUltra, and they set up safe houses in San Francisco, New York, and the prostitutes would go out on the street and recruit people for tricks. The CIA people would watch the tricks through one-way mirrors and monitor the sex, and the prostitutes would slip the Johns, LSD and other hallucinogens, and these people were totally unaware that they were involved in any kind of government experiment, totally unaware that they were going to get LSD at all, gave no consent whatsoever. So most of the time the subjects were somebody who was one notch down in the power setup. They were either an employee of the institution where the doctor was doing the research, they were a patient, they were somebody in the military who, loosely speaking, volunteered but really didn't have much choice, or they were prisoners. So usually it was somebody who was under the control of the administration and under the control of the doctor somehow, to some extent.
Now, what specifically, what prisons were involved in the mind control experiments?
One of the prisons that was the New Jersey Reformatory at Bordentown, which is in Pennsylvania. The investigator there was Carl Pfeiffer, who had a lot of MKUltra and MKSearch money. He was also, besides being at the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Research Institute, which is where he did the work at Bordentown, he was the chairman of the Department of Pharmacology at one of the major universities in Atlanta, Emory University. And while he was there, he did LSD experiments on people in the Atlanta penitentiary. There was the narcotics farm in Lexington, Kentucky, which was a prison. It was mainly for drug-related offenders. And then one of the more sinister ones is Vacaville State Prison in California. Mm-hmm. Vacaville State Prison was an MK search site where they did drug research related to the drug Pemoline, which is called Sylert. The trade name is Sylert. It's used for attention deficit disorder in kids. They were using it to study memory enhancement through drugs. And that was at the same time as Donald DeFries was an inmate at Vacaville. Donald DeFries was the head of the
SLA
Liberation Army that captured Patty Hearst. At the same time that there was drug research going on at the New Jersey Reformatory at Bordentown, a man was in a prison there whose name was Louis Castillo, and he was later arrested in the Philippines on suspicion of being there to assassinate Marcos, Ferdinand Marcos. And he exhibited five distinct personalities on 40 different interviews conducted by the Philippines FBI. There was consultation from the Philippines FBI to the American FBI in his case. Also, because he alleged that he was involved in the Kennedy assassination, there was a consultation with Gerald Ford, who was on the Warren Commission. So all of this is sort of tied into all kinds of aspects of the whole second half of the 20th century. It's a very, very twisted, convoluted history. The people who were the expert witnesses for Patty Hearst, who were saying that she had been captured by the Symbionese Liberation Army and brainwashed by them using the mind control techniques of destructive cults, which are very similar to the mind control techniques of the CIA and military mind control. Those witnesses included Robert Lifton, Margaret Singer, Martin Orne, and a psychiatrist named Jolly West. And Jolly West and Martin Orne had top secret clearance and had MKUltra money. Their testimony about Patty Hearst was that a new identity named Tanya had been created through these brainwashing techniques. And Patty Hearst identified herself as Tanya when she robbed a bank. She was convicted and found guilty and actually sentenced to jail for that. So the experts in a lot of the CIA mind control programming were very aware of the possibility of creating an artificial multiple personality through mind control techniques. And they testified that this had been done by this character, Donald DeFries, who was a black criminal who was basically a petty criminal and thief. There's several strange twists to that story. One of the strange twists, which is somewhat documented but not completely documented, is that Donald DeFries, according to several different sources and according to Patty Hearst's biography as well, was actually an employee of the CIA during the Vietnam War. He was a psychological warfare... Not Donald DeFries himself, another man named Colston Westbrook, was an employee of the CIA full-time and was a psychological warfare expert in Vietnam. And according to these several different books, he came back and got a job at the University of Berkeley as a language instructor. And then he entered Vacaville Prison under cover of the Black Cultural Association, which was a black prisoners and inmates program. And under cover of that Black Cultural Association, he used mind control techniques on Donald DeFries and actually gave him his code name of Sank and designed the seven-headed cobra logo of the Symbionese Liberation Army. Then Donald DeFries was transferred from a maximum security facility at namely Vacaville, to a low security facility from which he immediately escaped, and several months after then captured Patty Hearst and used fairly sophisticated mind control techniques on her and created this Manchurian candidate second identity bank robber in her named Tanya.
So unless all of this is highly coincidental, what you're saying is that the SLA was a CIA creation.
I don't know for a documented fact that that's true, but that's what these several different books are alleging. And the information is fairly detailed, and I'm trying to research up on that. But it's absolutely known for a fact that these two doctors, Dr. West and Dr. Orne, had extensive funding from all branches of military intelligence.